Since 1936, the National Wildlife Federation has worked with hunters and anglers to pass the most important conservation laws in American history and to protect our sporting traditions. This podcast explores our history, our values, and the work we do to safeguard the fish and wildlife that fuel our passions. We are NWF Outdoors.
The NWF Outdoors Podcast is brought to you by Hunt to Eat, an inclusive hunting apparel company with a focus on community, real food, and conservation. Check out Hunt to Eat's NWF line, wild game recipes, and hunting and fishing designs at hunttoeat.com, and enter the code WILDLIFE10 to get 10% off your order.
All right, welcome everybody to the NWF Outdoors Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Kindle. And today we are bringing you a very special edition. We got some excellent conservation news last week as something that we could truly be thankful for. Right before we had the Thanksgiving holiday, we heard that one of the biggest conservation fights we've had for the last decade reached a major milestone that we can all be happy about. The Army Corps of Engineers denied a permit for the Pebble Mine in Alaska. And we're lucky today. I'm honored and I'm really happy that he agreed to come on to have Chris Wood join us. He's the president and CEO of Trout Unlimited. And Trout Unlimited has been the key driver to getting this mine and protecting, getting this mine denied and protecting one of the most incredible places on earth, one of the best salmon fisheries left on earth. And so I'm just honored that you decided to come, Chris, and thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks, Aaron. The honor's mine. It's great to see you again and to hear your voice again.
Yeah, and Chris and I are old friends. I used to work at Trout Unlimited, so we've known each other for a while, and he's always been gracious with his time, and this is no exception. And I'll tell our listeners just a little bit about Chris, and then we'll dive in. So Chris, before he was at Trout Unlimited, he worked for the U.S. Forest Service as the Senior Policy and Communications Advisor to the Chief. And he began his career way back when as a temporary employee in Idaho, and has worked his way up through a couple of the agencies. He's done, he's an author, he's done multiple papers and some books, and he's really just one of the leaders in stream restoration and conservation across the country, and has been at the helm now for what, looking like 20 years almost now, Chris.
10 years, okay. At the helm. Nearly okay. 20 at TU, though.
Well, good. 20 years there and 10 years at the helm. So obviously you did something right on your way up. Well, awesome, Chris. First, we always like to ask our listeners what we've been doing outside. And I know it's a good time to get outside and be with our families, because that's about the only folks we can spend some time with responsibly. So tell us what you've been up to.
Yeah, that's right. Well, what you just said, spending time with my family, in our case, we have a place in West Virginia, and we're able to leave DC and get to West Virginia without stopping or, interacting with anyone else, so we can be safe there. We had Thanksgiving here in DC, and I hunted the first 3 days of opening of gun season in West Virginia before Thanksgiving. Passed on a few nice bucks in the hope that I'll see something better this weekend. And then the other thing that I've been doing that's of interest is we've been invaded by this scourge called Russian olive, or autumn olive, some people call it. And it's an invasive bush that just completely takes over a landscape. And so I've been having fun with my boys with a chainsaw and some herbicide, trying to get rid of that Russian olive from our place in West Virginia.
But how old are your boys now, Chris? They got to be.
Yeah, it's insane. Two of them are 6'3", so two of them tower over me, and they're 17, 15, and 10, 11.
Wow.
11.
Wow, I bet they're beating dad on the basketball court now, huh?
That's really funny that you say that. So the two-on-two teams, we have a half court down at our place in West Virginia, and the two-on-two teams are Wiley and Casey, the two oldest boys, and then I play with Henry Trace. And Henry Trace and I consistently beat Wiley and Casey, oh, wow. Not necessarily because we're better, but because dad still knows how to set a pick and plays defense. The other three are just gunners.
Chris is a good ball player. We've actually played ball together a time or two. So
holy cow, that's right.
Well, let's jump in, Chris. I think I'd just like to give you the opportunity to tell people who don't know, what is Bristol Bay? What's at stake up there? You know, just give us an overview of the people, the place, the wildlife. Just dive in and I'll ask questions as I hear them.
Right on, Aaron. Bristol Bay is one of the most remarkable landscapes in the country. And I say that with great seriousness. You mentioned this earlier, but about half, nearly half of all of the world's wild sockeye come from the Bristol Bay system and largely the Quijack River system. The most productive Chinook or King run in the world is often in the an adjacent river system, the Nushagak River. What a lot of sportsmen and women really love about Bristol Bay is that the fact that they have these giant native rainbow trout. These aren't steelhead. These are, you know, potentially 30, 31, 32 inch rainbow trout that move out of a giant lake called Lake Iliamna, and they move into the rivers when the fish are spawning, and they're feeding on salmon eggs and the decaying flesh of the bodies, etc. So as they get very, very big, these are giant rainbow trout. Anyway, it was precisely in the headwaters of the Nushagak and the Quijack rivers that a Canadian mining company proposed building what would have been probably the world's largest open pit gold, silver, and copper mine. It was a patently bad idea. It was proposed about 15 years ago. The company took their sweet time getting the permit developed. Ultimately, the Trump administration forced them to basically get a permit done within a time certain period. And the happy news, and frankly, the unexpected news that you mentioned was the Corps of Engineers denied that permit that they needed under the Clean Water Act to be able to build this massive gold mine. So just a huge victory for conservation. You know, and what's really neat about this one, Aaron, is when you look at the history of the state of Alaska, most of the conservation in that state was kind of forced on it. Either by the White House or by the U.S. Congress. And what was neat about this campaign was not only did organizations like NWF and TU and, you know, Wild Salmon Center and other groups come together and work, you know, in a concerted way to try to stop that mine. But the local opposition was phenomenal. In some of those Alaska Native villages like King Salmon and Igiagig and Dillingham, the opposition to the mine was, you know, in the 80s, 85%, 86% around. And as you know, Alaska is a very pro-development state. The opposition to the mine in the state ran in the 60% range. And so it was a real demonstration of the power of building, local voices to speak out for their lands and waters. And, we never would have won that fight without the support of, as I mentioned, groups like NWF, other environmental groups were involved. The NRDC was very involved. But what really made the campaign so powerful was how the Alaska Native villages and the commercial fishermen came together and organized with the conservation community. And we, for 15 years, we fought this absolutely boneheaded idea of a mine. And by gosh, we beat it back. Now, we're not done. You know, we need some other scurrilous company could come along and propose another mine up there, right? This doesn't protect the land in Bristol Bay. It just says that this mine cannot be built, the Pebble Mine. And so part of what we need to do now is we need to work with, you know, those Alaska Native villages, the Native corporations in the area, the state and the Alaska delegation to come up with a long-term solution that actually protects the land and the fishery so that, we don't have to have these kind of fights every couple of years.
And these are, you know, wilderness quality, world-class type lands that we're talking about too. I mean, grizzly bears, everything under the sun, right? Can you talk a little bit more about the other critters and things up there?
It's incredible. I mean, it's absolutely astonishing. You can't, the Bristol Bay region is about the size of Ohio. It's a big, big region. And there's about 7,000 people who live there. It's a completely undeveloped landscape. I remember 15 years ago, before I had my knees replaced, I was still running. And I went to Bristol Bay for the first time, you know, I was training for a half marathon. And I remember going to Bristol Bay thinking, well, I'll be able to train when I'm not fishing. There's nowhere to run. There's no roads. To get into the lodge I fish at, you fly into a tiny little town called Igiagig. It's a little more than an airstrip. And then you take a boat upriver to the lodge. I mean, this is a completely undeveloped landscape. And what they would have had to do to build this mine was to industrialize the landscape, literally. They would have had to build a power plant that is larger than the one that feeds the city of Anchorage. They would have had to build these massive earthen dams, hundreds of feet high, to hold back the toxic tailings that would have been produced by the dam. And this is in a highly seismically active area. It was a recipe for disaster. And you talk about wildlife. I mean, this place is like, it's America's Serengeti. I know that's an overused cliche, but grizzly bear, caribou. I have fished up there at a place called the Brooks Range, and that's where they, Katmai National Park, rather, on the Brooks River. And that's where you always see those famous photographs of the bears at a waterfall with their mouth open and trying to catch the fish as they jump. Well, there are so many bears there that the guides teach you. It's actually not that fun to fish it. The first time, it's just totally cool because bears everywhere. I mean, 10 bears to every person in the area. But the guides teach you when you hook up with a fish and a bear becomes a little bit too interested, you drop your rod straight down. And maybe even break it off if you need to, because, you know, they really live in fear of the bears getting acclimated to the anglers catching fish. And then, you know, oh, look, that fish is a little slower than the rest. I'm going to go charge after them.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's like no place on earth. I went into Igiagig 2 years ago. A friend of mine, Brian Kraft, owns a lodge up there, Alaska Sportsman's Lodge. It's a great, great lodge. And we went in to see one of the local school teachers in the town of Igiagig. And what was so cool, Aaron, was, you know, the kids, they don't ride bikes to school like you and I might have when we grew up. They ride their ATVs to school. And what was so cool was seeing all these No Pebble Mine stickers emblazoned on these off-road vehicles that the kids were, you know, taking to get into class every day.
Yeah, it's a really kind of community effort, and community in kind of the broadest sense you can think of, right? It's nationwide, locals, people from all over, people who just care. I've never been there, but I tell people, you know, you have me at hello. You tell me half the world's salmon are threatened, and I just say no way, no how. I mean, it's a no-brainer, right? I mean,
well, you think about it this way, okay? Put this in perspective. In the Columbia and Snake River basins, we have spent upwards of $18 billion in a dramatically failed effort to recover Snake River and Columbia River salmon. And all we have to do to keep intact half of the world's wild sockeye salmon, all we have to do is have the wisdom to leave Bristol Bay alone, to just leave it alone, to leave it as God made it, because we can't improve it. And, happily, this permit denial leaves us in a good position right now to come up with a long-term solution, working with those partners that I mentioned, to do just that, to leave Bristol Bay alone.
Awesome. Well, let's back up just one step too, Chris. Tell me, you know, when did this mining project arise? You know, what were the plans? Who were the players? You know, just walk folks through how this came about. It, you know, we sit here and talk about all the values and it seems so obvious that, boy, why would you even try to mine that? Or as soon as you did, you'd be jumped all over. You know, just take us a little bit through that history and how that came about.
Yeah, happy to, Aaron. Well, I first learned about it 15 years ago. We had a guy on staff at the time named Tim Bristol, and he said, you know, this pebble mine that they're talking about, you know, has the potential to really be problematic. And my first instinct was, pebble mine? Do we actually mine pebbles? I literally didn't even, I'd never even heard of the deposit before.
Yeah.
And I went up there and I met this guy named Brian Kraft. And he's, as I mentioned, he's the owner of the Alaska Sportsman's Lodge. And Brian told me that, you know, he was really worried and other lodge owners in the area were really worried about this mine. And, you know, he was trying to push to you to take it on as a campaign. And so we did. We learned about the proposed mine. We learned about what a devastatingly bad idea it was to build a mine like this in that kind of an area. And it was interesting because Brian, like many Alaskans, was initially pro-mine because, you know, it's an area with a fairly low household income, as you can imagine. You know, jobs are important in those rural communities. And a lot of people like Brian initially thought that, well, this will be great. It'll provide, you know, good, high paying family wage jobs for people. And but the more they learned about it, the more they realized, no, this is a bad idea. So it was about 15 years ago that we got involved. It was largely based on, the council of the lodges in the areas that in the area that we had relationships with. But then it blossomed into a tremendous campaign. The commercial fishing industry in the state of Alaska was fantastic. This is a fishery like no other. They have a relatively short season, but they catch just a tremendous amount of fish. A couple of years ago, they caught 60 million sockeye salmon. Think about that, 60 million wow. fish. And it's a totally sustainable fishery. Papers have been written about the fishery because the incredible diversity, the genetic diversity, the geographic diversity, and the life history diversity of these fish allows for them to be pounded for a really intense 2-week period. But they still meet all their escapement goals, and it's a completely sustainable fishery. There's no hatcheries involved or anything. This is a fishery as God made it. And
so folks are eating sockeye salmon at home. Most folks, wild caught salmon, it's very likely from there.
That's right. It's very likely to come from Bristol Bay. Now, there are more famous fisheries like, you know, the Copper River. People talk about that sure. fishery. And part of the reason that that's such a highly desired salmon is that it swims a lot further. You know, it has to travel further. So when it enters the estuary before it goes up into the river, the fish are bigger and fatter, and the Bristol Bay fish aren't as commercially valuable, but they're the heart of our nation's of our world's really sockeye fishery. So anyway, it was, as I mentioned, it was really the coming together in a really positive way of commercial fishing interests, conservation interests, and local people. And we were all on the same page for 15 years. And our role at TU was basically to try to engage as many sportsmen and women. NWF played a big role in that, as you know, Aaron. The outdoor industry was tremendous. You know, companies like Orvis and Sims and a lot of our other partners, they all made their voices heard in a really positive way. And ultimately, even the Alaska delegation came out against the mine in the very end, which was, you know, frankly, unheard of. Alaska, as I mentioned, it's a very pro-development state. The company that wanted to mine it was a little company in Canada called Northern Dynasty, and they had never developed a mine before. And what they were after was, because it's an incredibly lucrative deposit, what they were hoping was a major would come in and buy in into their operation. And so and they had that. At one point, they had a couple, two, three major international mining companies that had tens of millions of dollars invested in the Pebble Mine, and they pulled out because they thought it was too risky. Anglo American, one of the largest mining companies in the world, not only pulled out of the deposit because they thought it was too risky, they forfeited $350 million in order to get out of that. And it just goes to show you that there's no way to build a mine safely in that landscape. There's no way to have industrial scale mining of any kind in Bristol Bay if we want to keep that fishery intact.
That's a good way to sum it up. Talk a little bit too, because there's an interface, I think. I mean, hard rock mining. How many hard rock mines have a great story where you go back and you say, those are all cleaned up now and everything's fine? I mean, it's kind of unheard of, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's interesting. I want to be careful here because we actually work with a lot of mining companies to clean up abandoned mines. You know, around the West, we've got a legacy of something like 500,000, if you can believe it, abandoned mines. Yeah. These are old hard rock mines that were, you know, mined 100 years ago. The companies that mine them are long gone, and nobody's on the hook to clean them up. And you know, we have worked, as you may recall, Aaron, we've worked pretty hard to try to create momentum to clean up abandoned mines. And we have seen some really good action from companies like Freeport McMoRan and others who are investing in cleaning up these abandoned mines. But the fact is, you don't find very many major industrial scale mines that have a happy ending when it comes to fish and wildlife. And yeah. it just wasn't worth the risk of, having, a tailings blowout or to have, Bristol Bay landscape. It's like a sponge. When you get up in an airplane and you fly over it, it's prairie potholes everywhere. It's a totally wet landscape. And so one of the concerns that we had was, even if they used an impervious material to try to hold the tailings back, there would be some leaching of these, toxins through the water system and down into the fishery. And it was just it never ceases to amaze me how strong greed can be in terms of motivating people. Because if there is one place that we should not mine, it's Bristol Bay.
Yeah, and and I think the hard rock mining issue, by the way, I'll just give you a shout out for that, because TU has done some excellent work both with the companies and the legacy mines. There's also, beyond the big ones, there's a million little ones scattered all over the landscape, which cumulatively can have a big effect too. And I'll give a shout out to Jason Willis, my fellow Salidan here in Colorado.
Who there you go.
Quite a bit down here and does great work. So, but yeah, that's a big issue. And TU has been a leader there, both being a collaborative leader with grabbing companies and other stakeholders and really doing good work. So I'll give you another shout out there. What about talk a little bit about the nuts and bolts of this recent development. What did it take to get us here? And then now what's the next steps? What do we need to look for? What should folks be on the lookout for to make sure they stay engaged as this goes further?
Yeah, that's great, Aaron. It's funny, I'm too close to this issue. Sometimes I forget that there's a whole long story that people don't really understand. So there were dozens of permits that the mining company would need to get to be able to build a mine of this size. And the one that we were really focused on was the federal permit. And it's called a dredge and fill permit. And the Obama administration had actually tried to use their authority under the Clean Water Act to preemptorily deny the permit. So they basically took an approach under the Clean Water Act that said, this landscape isn't appropriate for large-scale industrial mining, so we're going to put it off limits. And what happened then was the Pebble Limited Partnership, which is the name of the consortium that wanted to build the mine, they litigated, and the Trump administration decided to settle the litigation. So they basically told the company, "All right, fine, we're not going to do this thing that the Obama administration wanted." Wanted to do. We're going to drop that, and we're going to give you 3 years to develop a plan of operation and to submit it to us for a permit under the Clean Water Act. And the company went out and they did their analysis, and they turned it in. They turned in this summer what they call a final environmental impact statement. Or an FEIS if you're a former recovering bureaucrat like me. And the FEIS, it basically laid out all the options and the potential risks and showed that, several hundred miles of stream would be lost. Hundreds of acres of wetlands would be lost as a result of this project. But it seemed that, and the final step in the process after you do that FEIS is you have to get something called a record of decision. And there's often a lag time between the environmental analysis and the record of decision. And we were in that lag time. And, part of what we were doing was, and this was a little controversial. I'll tell you, many in the conservation community thought that we were on a quixotic mission by continuing to lobby the Trump White House. And we kept taking small business owners back to the White House. We flew tribal leaders back and had them meet with their delegation. And with the White House, we had outfitters and guides come back and meet with, the delegation and the White House. And over time, we started hearing mutterings that, this may be a problem. And then there was a bolt out of the blue. And I think it was in large part due to the good footwork, the good conservation footwork of groups like TU and NWF. But the bolt out of the blue was a guy by the name of Nick Ayers, who is Vice President Pence's former chief of staff. He tweeted that Bristol Bay was the wrong place to build a mine. And lo and behold, a few minutes later, none other than Donald Trump Jr. retweeted that and said he agreed. And we knew that Donald Trump Jr., who is a member of Trout Unlimited, maybe a member of NWF for all I know, he said, I think this is the wrong place to build a mine as well. And, then Tucker Carlson took up the act from there. Tucker Carlson, who is a TU member in good standing, a very controversial radio, talk show host, as you know, but very popular and very popular with the president, importantly. He did a segment on basically talking about with Johnny Morris, of the owner of Bass Pro Shops, talking about what a bad idea Pebble Mine was. And then he did a follow up with Brian Kraft, who I mentioned earlier. And so, there was a crescendo of momentum to deny the permit. And what the Corps said early in the fall was, all right, we're going to actually, it's interesting. I have it right here. They said, the Corps of Engineers finds under Section 404 of the Clean Water Act that the project as proposed would likely result in significant degradation of the environment and would likely result in significant adverse effects on the aquatic system or human environment, et cetera, et cetera. Therefore, the Corps finds that the project as currently proposed cannot be permitted under Section 404 of the Clean Water Act. And what they did was they said, you have to go out and do mitigation in this landscape. It's a pristine landscape that is of like size and kind to the degradation that the mine would cause. And it was almost like, remember that story from high school, the trials of Hercules, and he had to clean out the Aegean stables and all that. This was a trials of Hercules size mitigation standard, because you can't improve something that's wilderness quality. So what the government said was, you need to go show us how you're going to, improve what is already wilderness quality lands. And ultimately, with the Pebble Limited Partnership, they submitted a plan. We haven't seen what they submitted, but several days later, or actually it was probably about 10 days later, the Corps came out. It was on Wednesday before Thanksgiving. The Corps came out and said, we're denying this permit. And effectively ending this chapter in the fight, and now beginning the next step in the process. And I'm going to answer your question now about what people can do. What we need to do now is we need to help convince Senator Murkowski, Senator Sullivan, Congressman Young, the governor, that landscape is too important to be developed, and come up with a long-term plan to protect the landscape and the underlying mineral deposit. It's not going anywhere. The minerals are going to stay in the ground, and making sure that we protect that place so it continues to, provide the benefits, the social and economic benefits it does, is really important. I didn't mention this, Aaron, but that fishery supports about 17,000 jobs every year. It's like a $1.5 billion fishery. And that doesn't even include the sport fishing aspects, the people who spend millions of dollars to fly in there and fish at these lodges, nor does it include, perhaps most importantly, how important the fishery is to the Alaska Native villages who have depended on those fish for sustenance for millennia.
Sure. So that's a pretty good overview, Chris. From now forward, are the plans in place to kind of pitch what you mentioned to decision makers? Is there already folks formulating a plan to conserve the area? Talk a little bit about where that lies and, who's involved and what else needs to be done.
Yeah, those are nascent conversations right now. It's just beginning to happen. I think everybody's pedal was to the metal up until Wednesday of last, less than a week ago. But there have been a few folks, smart folks, who were sitting down thinking about, well, what does it look like? What are we going to do here? Is it going to be a land swap? Is it a cash purchase? How do we make this work? And really the conversation that needs to happen isn't necessarily with a bunch of fast talking white guys like me. It needs to start with the people from, you know, King Salmon, Iggy Agig, Dillingham, you know, those Alaska villages that are so dependent on that fishery. They need to be the loudest voice in the room when it comes to, you know, options for protecting it over time.
Yeah, good point. That's great. So since that hasn't happened, is there, you know, for folks who want to know more, and I know you guys have I can't recall exactly the name, Keep Bristol Bay something. I don't recall exactly. You can say it and we'll include it in the show notes. But, you know, for folks who want to learn more and see more about what's gone on, where should they look?
They can go to a couple places. One is standup.tu.org. And then you'll see a Bristol Bay, you know, section in there. Another one is savebristolbay.org. That's another good site, to chock full of information. And on that Stand Up to You page, you'll be able to take action and notify the Alaska delegation or your member of Congress that you want to see Bristol Bay permanently protected, and encouraging them to, you know, to get engaged in that effort.
Yeah, let's get that done. We have I know on our NWF Outdoors page, we have some information about Bristol Bay as well. It's just one of those things that's just seminally important to conservation and to everybody that should really pay attention to this. It's kind of a harbinger for where we're going as a country and for conservation. If you can't protect that place, boy, we're in trouble.
No, that's wise. I really agree with you. I mean, this is you know, there's an aspect of this that's kind of like, well, of course you won. You know, who's going to allow a mine to be built in a landscape that's that important? But, you know, you could say the same thing about, you know, in the 1950s, Idaho had a 2-month long fishing season where you could keep 2 salmon a day from the Middle Fork of the Snake River. That's how prevalent the fish were. 2 fish a day for 2 months. And now we're seeing 1% of their fish make it back. You know, who would have thought that we would have had that incredible abundance and richness just 50, 60 years ago, 70 years ago, I guess. And then come up with this idea that, hey, maybe we ought to build some concrete monoliths and put them right in the middle of the river system. And we'll see what happens with the fish. Well, you know, we know that that hasn't been such a good news story. So it's important to stay vigilant. You know, I mean, I think sometimes we, you know, one of the dangers of conservation is that, you know, we're really overseeing loss in many ways. And it's easy to become despondent or negative or cynical in the face of, you know, managing loss, whether it's loss of wild fish or native species or open space, you know, water quality, name your issue. It's really important when we get these victories like this one that we take the time and we celebrate. And the fact that, you know, it happened on opening week of deer season was a great blessing for me, because it was one less thing to bother me as I should have been scanning the woods for big bucks.
Yeah. And a very good thing to be thankful for over the holiday there.
Amen.
Chris, so is there any scenario by which, you know, you see this reviving and having a chance to be a mine still? Or do we, you know, I know you said we have to stay diligent and vigilant, and obviously we do, but I mean, it seems like every time it comes up, it's another nail in the coffin. And I want to hear finally that it's the final nail. I think we all do. So just talk about, is there any chance?
Well, you know, it's like I said earlier, you know, greed is an incredibly strong motivating factor for people. It is an incredibly rich deposit. The reason they call it the pebble deposit is that it's not like many traditional bodies of ore that are kind of found in seams in the ground. It's a highly mineralized area that's spread across acres and acres and acres of land. And so you really have to develop the entire landscape, but it's incredibly mineralized. I mean, there are tons of gold and copper and silver in there. And so, you know, as long as people have the ability to potentially, you know, put a permit together to build a mine there, you know, we've got to remain, you know, eyes wide open. And I think, you know, it's funny because, you know, you've seen those stickers with the, you know, the circle and it's the pebble on it and then this, you know, a line through it. Well, we've become really fixated on the Pebble Mine, but it's not about the Pebble Mine so much as it is saving Bristol Bay. And that's that next step that I talked about. That's going to, and I think everyone, Aaron, understands how important this is. And, you know, that frankly, a fly-by-night two-bit mining company from Canada came within, you know, a signature on a record of decision of being able to build one of the most offensive mines in the history of the country should be motivating for most people to realize that we've got to finish the job and we've got to, that's state-owned land, and we have to figure out how to work with the state to protect that land.
Yeah, that's a good segue too, Chris, because one other thing I wanted to ask you about was just, you know, the flagship fishery here that's really supporting a lot of the salmon across the Northwest coast and the state of salmon in general. You touched on it a little bit, but some of the dwindling numbers we're seeing, salmon and steelhead and some of the issues. And can you talk about that a little bit and place, you know, give some more context with the importance of, if you have this pristine place protected, how much more that staves off some of the other problems?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's, I don't know if it staves it off, but it should be a wake-up call is what it should be. You know, in 1991, there was a seminal paper that came out in the Journal of the American Fisheries Society. It was called Salmon at a Crossroads. And the authors, it was Jack Williams, Willa Nelson, and Jim Likatowicz. They said that we've already lost 214 stocks of salmon, and they identified hundreds that were at risk of extinction. And that was in the 90s. The situation's only gotten worse, and it's being compounded now by climate change. You know, you think about the Snake River Basin, you know, what we've done is we've created these lethally hot bathtubs in these rivers, and it's riverine environment. These fish don't, when they make their migration out to the ocean, they're not really swimming out to the ocean. They're being flushed by the river. And so what happens is when you get these reservoirs behind these dams, like on the lower Snake River, the fish get backed up there and the water can become lethally hot, and it makes the fish that much more vulnerable to predators, you know, walleye, birds, you know, pinnipeds. There's a whole host of, sure, of things that make them, they can be preyed on by. And again, you know, we have this incredible fishery in Bristol Bay. You know, 60 million fish a couple of years ago were caught there. You know, supply, it's a $17 billion industry. I'm sorry, 17,000 jobs every year, and $1.5 billion industry. And all we have to do to leave it that way is just to leave it alone. You look at the comparison of what's happening in the Columbia and Snake Rivers, where most salmon and steelhead are either listed or proposed for listing under the Endangered Species Act, which is the law that we use to basically keep fish and wildlife on life support while we try to figure out how to recover. Almost every one of those fish are listed. And in Bristol Bay, you've got this incredibly vibrant, healthy fishery. And we just, all we have to do is leave it alone to keep it intact.
Yeah, and salmon is already, as you said, a kind of an all hands on deck issue. You know, we, in the Federation family, we have a few affiliates up there, Conservation Northwest, Steelheaders, and Idaho Wildlife Federation, who are working tons on those dams. And there's been some new developments. I'm glad to see that. I know TU's leading the way on a bunch of that too. So I'm glad to see that. And I'm hoping one day we can get back up there and fish salmon where they used to be and celebrate that victory too, Chris.
Amen.
And I'm gonna give you a chance to do a parting shot. You've been very gracious with your time, and I'm gonna try to let you go here, but just give me a parting shot. What should people be thinking about as we move forward? And I'll make mine, and then I'll bid you farewell, my man.
Yeah, that's great, Aaron. Well, I think my parting shot will be less of a shot than just a big note of thanks, because NWF is one of Trout Unlimited's best partners. And whether it's Bristol Bay, NWF is the lead litigant on the Snake River, basically to remove those dams. Or cleaning up abandoned mines, passing Good Samaritan legislation to make cleaning up abandoned mines easier. NWF has been just a tremendous partner to TU, and it's been a real honor for me to be on your show and to talk to your members, Aaron, and great to hear your voice and see your face again, too.
You too, sir. And I would just agree with you. First off, we've been great partners. I continue to work with a lot of your excellent staff there at TU, and just happy I get to keep doing that and keep those relationships alive, even as I'm over here at NWF now. And I guess I would just tell our listeners, you know, if you love salmon, you love wild places, you know, you want to be able to fish salmon in your lifetime, you know, take care of these places, follow this campaign. We'll put up links to the campaign that Chris talked about earlier and some other stuff folks can connect with, and just take care of these places and know places like Bristol Bay, they don't make new ones. So take care of them and help out as you can.
That's great. You know, there's a book, this Why We Need a Free-Flowing Lower Snake River. I'll send you a link to this, Aaron. I bet your listeners and your viewers would really enjoy it. It's a great science-based document about why we need to take out those four lower Snake River dams.
Yeah. Send me any links you want and we'll put them in the show notes and we'll get this baby posted so folks know right away they've got something to celebrate and how they can get engaged. And
fantastic.
Just thanks again, Chris. Excellent to see your face and talk to you. And thank you so much for your time and all the good work.
Thanks, Aaron. You too. Talk to you again soon, I hope.
Yes, sir. Take care.
All right. Bye-bye now.
We are NWF Outdoors.